ദാരുഹമിവ ബന്ധന മൃത്യോർമുക്ഷീയമാമൃതാത്.
Good afternoon and good evening and good morning. I'm so happy to be with you, great ones. Greetings, great ones, because you really, really are, as we enter into our third class on the path of living and dying. What it means to say that you are great ones, and I know it's not a way that we normally think of ourselves, it's not only because you're practitioners and teachers deeply engaged in the great questions of life. It's not only because of the fragrance, the radiance that really comes off the posts on the listserv from so many of you. I would say really from all of you, even the most practical questions and sharings have this kind of fragrance of sangam, of satsang about them. And what I was contemplating as I waited for the call to start was the whole concept of sangam and of refuge. In Buddhism and in my own tradition, though we worded it somewhat differently, the understanding is that it's very important to be able to take refuge, to be able to take refuge in the invisible great beings and in our own gurus and the lineage gurus that so many of us are connected to take refuge in the self, in the light of our own consciousness, and to take refuge in the sangam, which so powerfully is present here. Before we begin our invocation and go on to the matter of our class today, a couple of things. First, I want to give you kind of a through line. We'll be meditating, of course. Actually, we're going to be practicing some of the contemplations and meditations we did last week, particularly deepening our experience of the Sushumna Nadi and the presence of the Shiva being or the being whom you feel most comfortable invoking. We'll be doing more of the awareness of awareness practice and some other contemplations. And today we will begin discussing karma and what it has to do with our death process, which is everything. And we'll hopefully get to some conversation about the after-death realms. But we're also, I promise, cross my heart and hope to die, that we'll get to questions today. So, and again, one more thing before we chant. I think many of you are realizing, if you hadn't before, how skillful it can be to deal with regrets as we go along, rather than trying to plow them under or put them into the famous black box in the mind or to pretend it didn't happen and just keep soldiering on. For me, and I know for several of you, as several of you have shared, the skillful work we're able to do with metabolizing regrets has really been life-transforming. I say that from years of experience and seeing the dramatic effect working with a particular charged incident or regret can have on freeing me up in day-to-day life. So, and since we all do stuff that we're not happy about, sometimes on a daily basis, sometimes very small things, but if you have a perfectionist mind, small things can seem big. And because we all grow up being shamed, not just for mistakes, but often for qualities in ourselves that are actually part of who we are, which we essentially can't help, but which sometimes our caretakers or teachers or peers find triggering. And of course, we internalize all that sometimes before we even know what we're doing. And this gives a lot of weight to mistakes and failures as we go on. Of course, what our normal reaction is to something that didn't go well is to blame, either blame another person or to blame ourselves. And I have to say that for me, that's almost always my first response, which my years of practice have taught me to notice and then shift. But these habits of blame and the resentment and self-recrimination in various combinations literally create scars in the psyche that we will often keep revisiting, even unconsciously, and which can deeply skew how we relate to ourselves and others. So when we practice metabolizing regret, what we're actually doing is metabolizing the scars. We're removing, we're smoothing out the scars, which, of course, are in the neurophysiological system as well as in the subtle consciousness. So with salutation to ourselves for doing this work, we'll find our meditation posture and begin our opening series of practices. So let's take a deep breath, expanding the belly, and then a long exhalation, drawing the belly in towards the spinal column. And with the inhalation, feel that you are really receiving the energy that all of us are offering into the gathering. And with the exhalation, feel that you're offering back blessings. And as we do that, allow yourself to be aware of the presence of all of us, of this community, which, as I see from looking at my screen, is once again spread around six continents, like soul flames all around the world. Feel the presence of all of us sitting together. And then kindle your candle. I love to think of it as, you know, I think of myself as having this capacity for shooting a flame out of my fingers, like an old-fashioned sorcerer or like the Baal Shem Tov who supposedly could do that. And then just let the flame kindle your candle and place it very reverently in the center of this virtual circle. And now we'll make a formal aspiration for the benefit of others. One of the very beautiful ways that you can turn even an ordinary good action into a spiritually powerful action is to begin everything with an aspiration to that the action be of benefit. And by cultivating this habit of offering our actions for the benefit of all beings, or even for a particular being, and I know that all of us have people in our lives whom we would like to pray for or offer blessings to. But this habit of offering our thoughts and actions for the benefit of others actually creates a very, very powerful propulsion that can move us into better future states than we might otherwise be experiencing. And we can then bring that power into the present moment, just as when you imagine a beautiful future state, it becomes a reality for you in the moment that you're imagining it. So here's an aspiration prayer, courtesy of the late Buddhist teacher Trolog Kyabgun Rinpoche. I'll say it one sentence at a time, and you can say it after me. Inhaling, may what we're about to do give beneficial results. May it give us the power to be of real benefit to others. May it help us overcome our negativities and delusions. May what we are about to do clear away obstacles on our path. And may it propel us to a future state of enlightenment. And with that in mind, we offer our practice now and in the future for the benefit of all sentient beings. And now we'll chant the Mahamrityunjaya mantras with Yogi Hari, and we'll follow that immediately by chanting the Om Namah Shivaya Gurave mantras with Krishna Das.
Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Purvarukam Vabandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyamam Ritat Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukam Vabandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyamam Ritat Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukam Vabandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyamam Ritat Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukam Vabandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyamam Ritat Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukam Vabandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyamam Ritat
Can once again be present with your posture, really feeling the connection of your sits bones, the heaviness of your buttocks, your thighs against the seat, and feel how with the next exhalation you can allow the breath to begin helping uncoil your spinal column. The base becomes heavy, the spinal column moves upwards, your shoulder blades release onto the back, your chest lifts and opens. And with your breath, have the intention to release whatever holding intention you may have brought with you from the day, inhaling it into those parts of your body which might feel tight, and then gently exhaling with the thought, let go. The breath now begins to flow in and out through the central channel. Whether or not you are present to the subtlety of that central channel, simply feel that the inhalation flows in through the crown, down through the belly, down through the head, the throat, the heart, and then feel that the exhalation flows upward from the base, back up through the belly, through the heart, through the throat, perhaps ending in the Ajna Chakra in the center of the head, perhaps flowing upward, merging in the region above the crown. The inhalation flows in with Namah, the mantra of salutation and deep inner surrender, and the exhalation flows out with Shivaya. And at the end of the exhalation, you might feel that you yourself can let go just for a moment into the space that opens up with that final syllable, ya, feeling that the distractions, thoughts, issues that might have come up during the day are being offered into that spaciousness. And as Namah flows in, some of you may feel it flowing with a feeling of subtle auspiciousness, or even with a sense of golden white light that flows in from the higher regions and vitalizes you as the inhalation flows down towards the base. And then feel that that light is offered back up, vitalizing your body as the exhalation and the mantra Shivaya flows with the breath. And before you open your eyes, just notice what is it that's aware that you're listening, that you're sitting here, that you're present? What is it that's aware? And just let your attention touch this faculty of awareness itself just for 30 seconds right now. Become aware of your own awareness. So as you know, when we take a moment to become aware of awareness, we are actually tuning into the underlying suchness of mind itself, which is constantly forming thoughts and feelings out of the particles of infinitely subtle consciousness that we touch when we tune into our awareness, and which also tunes us into the source, the ultimate creativity. I'm calling it the naked soul right now, because that naked soul, which has its personal qualities that we're going to talk about in a few minutes, is also not personal at all. And with this reminder and an occasional reminder as we go along to stop for a moment and become aware of awareness, we're going to start talking about the topic of karma, which, as you know, is one of the most fascinating and stickiest topics there is, but which, in all the great teachings on death and dying, is pretty much at the core of what it is that we look at here. So, big drum roll. Dun-da-da-da, 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 karma. My personal favorite current definition of karma comes from Bob Thurman, the great Columbia professor, who's also a very well-known and communicator and expert on Tibetan Buddhism. He defines karma as the law of evolutionary causation, which I think is actually a very helpful, because in both Hindu and Buddhist thought, this idea that because our actions and thoughts have consequences, we are actually able to transform ourselves both as individuals and societies. And if you're familiar with the lore about the after-death realms, one thing you may be aware of, and which we'll talk about later, is that only human beings have this ability to do this. It's, you know, this particular waking state, earth plane, is called karma bhumi, meaning the place where we get to create karmas to transform ourselves through action. So karma is both a trap and is also our biggest ally. And to get both sides, it's helpful to understand the three types of karma, and we're going to be talking about them. I want to especially talk about the stored karma, the sanchitta karma, because that's so predominant in the journey that we take at death. As we'll see, in the true playground of karma is in the field of your consciousness, in your mind. And again, that conscious field is not just your individual consciousness. It's also the one great intelligent awareness within which everything in this multiverse, gross and subtle, appears. And the good news about this is that when you recognize that field, as when you're able to touch it and recognize that the ground of your being is your true self, the field itself devours our karmic tendencies. It can, piece by piece and sometimes all in a great swoosh, dissolve them into oneness with the great mind. And this actually happens, as some of you have been experiencing, on a small scale, every time you're able to hold a karmic situation or a regret in awareness, or start to dissolve it into the Sushumna Nadi, or offer it into the field of a great sage or saint or deity. And all of this happens on a subtle level, on a mental level, and therefore the fact that we carry the roots of our karmas in the mind is really good news. It's good news because your expanded awareness can dissolve it, and our karmic baggage can be dissolved, really by not only by what we do, but also by our attitudes towards what we experience. But it's also kind of difficult news, and that's because if what we really are is a mind, that means that whatever karmic seeds we've sown in the mind field or are carrying from the past are going to come with us as imprints in our personal consciousness when we die and will determine a lot of what our future holds for us. And we don't always know what's waiting. You know, hard-ass Buddhists and Hindu teachers use this, you know, this fact about the accumulated seeds of karma. They use this to scare us into working hard to accumulate merit and cultivate virtue, not to mention strive for liberation. We'll get into that later. But just in the, you know, it's somewhat similar to the way that Christian and Muslim teachers use the idea of heaven and hell. You know, not necessarily that successfully, I have to say, because, you know, the preaching we hear about hell in childhood might give us nightmares, but as countless writers have attested, it doesn't keep us from giving in to our teenage sexual urges or much else. So, but I find that it really is helpful to understand karma as our creative potential, as, you know, really the most exciting gift that we really have, that we are able to cultivate through aspiration and thought, and of course through actions that are of benefit to others and that are just plain good. As many of you know, the word karma comes from the Sanskrit root kra, kr, which means action, both the actions that we're performing now and of course the accumulated actions that create the template for our experience. So, and what I want to say is that the fact is that all actions create karma here on Karma Bhumi. There's no such thing as a consequence-free action, though the effect, the consequences of actions are very much determined by our ability to both to offer them and also to stay in some kind of contact with the essence, with the field of awareness, with the higher self. So the driving force, again, this is kind of the Karma 101, the driving force behind the karma we create now, as well as the karmas that we're hanging on to, is desire. What we want or believe we want, both now and in the future, the desires that we take with us after death are very often the ones that haven't been fulfilled in this or past lives, but they also can be part of our habitual desire nature, you know, which is different for each of us, but which are also often unconscious. And what the sages say and what we've come to understand, partly through the science of epigenetics, you know, the understanding of how much of the fears and desires and traumas of our parents and grandparents are carried in our genetic code. And this also actually ties in with something that's understood in some of the traditions, which is that our karmic tendencies, our desires, also come from ancestral issues that we've not only taken on from our this-life parents or family members, but also because most of our karmic relationships are with the same groups of souls with whom we get reincarnated from life to life. We don't always see them all this time, but pretty much everyone whom we get involved with over our lifetimes is part of our, let's call it, soul family or soul group. Group karma, family karma, ancestral karma, is not just genetic. It also consists of subtle threads that bind us to other souls. And, you know, when Buddha said that you should treat everyone you meet like your mother, this is part of what he means, because most people that you've been involved with in this life have at some point been your mother, or your father, and as you have been theirs. And I'm not going to suggest that you try and figure out these past life relationships right now, because the stories that we tell ourselves about our soul group can be kind of entangling for reasons that we'll get into later on today. But there's also the fact that, you know, when the Indian texts on karma say this very beautiful thing, that your spiritual practice is helping to liberate 7 generations of your ancestors, this is not just some kind of pie-in-the-sky idea. It's literally true, and it's a very important reason, very important benefit of our practice, because if you understand reincarnation, you realize not only that some of your ancestors are around in this life and having a hard time, but some of them might actually be you right now. You know, it's one of the, you know, the kind of mind-blowing facts about these teachings and these truths. Liberating your ancestors, in other words, you liberate yourself. So, you know, many of you are familiar with the ancestral work that's done in certain psychological communities or in some indigenous communities. And, you know, and it's sometimes said in these communities that the way we, if the roles we play often mirror those of deceased relatives. So our family configuration is going on. And again, any good clinical psychotherapist can tell you this, that we're playing out our family karmas with other people throughout our lives. The point, however, is that to some extent, the desires and the karmic propensities that come with us from life to life, maybe in seed form, are not necessarily self-generated. In other words, they're not your fault, which I kind of find helpful. That said, desire, whether conscious or unconscious, is always the seed of karma, which is why it's so powerful to cultivate selfless or, you know, high aspirations as desire, as intentions. If you remember this Upanishadic quote, as is your desire, so is your thought. As is your thought, so is your action. As is your action, so is your destiny. Very good to remember. As is your desire, so is your thought. As is your thought, so is your action. As is your action, so is your destiny. So whether you think of desire as a problem or as the motivating passion that drives us to excellence and spiritual progress, you know, it remains a determinative factor in just about everything we do. Even in spiritual life, it's important to want it, to want to evolve, to want to clear our minds, to want to pursue the sometimes difficult path of mindful action and awareness. Desire is the engine. So let's just take a moment to tune into that spark of mumukshutva, as it's called in Sanskrit. And I want to say that your desire, mumukshutva, means desire for liberation. Your mumukshutva doesn't have to be a carefully cultivated desire for ultimate liberation. It can be quite small. It can be a desire to get free of the entanglements that are boxing you in. It can be the desire even to liberate your mind in this moment from a particular or general form of suffering. So just get in touch with that spark of desire to evolve as a soul. See if you can feel what it feels like. Feel the sensation of it in your body. And imagine yourself feeding it. Imagine it growing, perhaps in your heart, perhaps widening. And imagine that if there are doubts that come up, oh, I could never do this, or this isn't really what I want, or what about my boyfriend, or, you know, I don't want to leave my kids, or those things that arise, just feel into that spark of mumukshutva and recognize how profoundly beneficial it's going to be to everyone in your life. as you cultivate it. Feeling your own desire to evolve, to transform, to free yourself, and to free others. I'm going to take you on a little tour of karmic terminology, which again is 101, but hey, this language is helpful. So remember, there are three basic kinds of karma, and there will be a handout on the course website, which will be up tomorrow, so you don't have to take notes. If you do take notes, I would suggest that you take notes of insights that come up, personal insights especially. First, potential karma, known in Sanskrit as kriyaman, which it has to do with the decisions, the choices, the actions that you're doing right now, moment to moment. For instance, my kriyaman karma right now is in the role I'm playing, the speaking I'm doing, the thinking I'm doing, my tuning into all of you. Yours is in monitoring your reactions, listening, maintaining your posture, being undistracted or distracted. So this is our area of free will, of choice, of active self-transformation. And of course, it's what our practice, our sadhana, is all about. Second, the big topic of destined karma, known in Sanskrit, in my tradition, there's different names for it, as prarabdha, which is responsible for your present life, character, and circumstances. And third, the stored karma called sanchitta, which has been accumulating as subtle traces in your unconscious mind for a long time. And the sanchitta karma is what it creates, what in the Indian traditions, in the Hindu and Buddhist traditions, is called the wheel of samsara, or transmigration. Samsara literally means wandering. And as we know, we wander all the time. Here and there, our mind wanders, and we wander from body to body. It's the sanchitta karma, which is not necessarily active now, but will bear fruit in the future, that propels you from life to life. So, you know, often when we use the word karma, we're thinking of the destined karma, which is sometimes compared to an arrow that's been already shot from the bow and which you can't call back, but which has to play out until it hits the target. And usually the big events in our life, where we're born, our parents, our body type, et cetera, are expressions of our prarabdha karma. I was reading a piece last night about Motown Records, and saw a picture of the Supremes, and I wondered, as people have, you know, if you've seen the movie Dreamgirls, you know that's a big topic, why did Diana Ross become the lead singer of the Supremes? And one of the other singers in the group was far more talented, and we might say it's because Diana Ross was better looking, or maybe because she was the boss's girlfriend, but basically it was her prarabdha karma to be a star. And as it's our prarabdha karma to have the kind of life and the kind of mind that seems to happen often without our willing it. So the stored karma, known as sanchitta, is compared to the arrows in your quiver. The present karma is the arrow that you're now putting into the bow in which you're about to shoot. Prarabdha karma, besides accounting for where you're born, who your parents are, your genetic heritage, also accounts for the time of death. In Indian tradition, it's said that you die when your karma is done in this body, and not before. Which, you know, when you read those stories about, I remember some from the tsunami in the Indian Ocean in Thailand, that there were people who were swept out to sea in the tsunami, and in that area, the ocean's very warm, they were able to swim back in. They didn't die. What a traditional Hindu or Buddhist would say is it's because it wasn't their time. Their karma was, they still had karma in this life. So events and relationships that are part of your destined karma are pretty hard to change, actually pretty much impossible to change. And I think many of us can think of examples where something, a difficult karmic situation, just seems to be out of our control. We have to live through it. Though attitude makes a huge difference. The activity of destined karma is like a strong wind. You know, there's a hurricane. If you've ever been in a hurricane force wind and you're trying to walk down the street when rain is pouring down and dust is coming in your eyes and you know, branches are falling, you can't see what's in front of you, it's very difficult to get where you're going. So we get blinded by the force of our karmic winds. And essentially, we work with karmas like this by the way we hold them. I have a friend whom I'll call Gina. I often tell stories about her, and I always call her Gina. We first met when we were both 25, and she was one of the golden girls of my generation. She was very attractive, incredibly charming, super smart, and really seemed to have a kind of a charmed life. She was very lighthearted. And in her 30s, she gave birth to a brain-damaged child, and for the next 35 years, that was what her life was about, which took enormous physical and emotional toll. It kind of wrecked her body. It broke up her marriage. And she never thought of giving him up. You know, even after she couldn't take care of him and he began living in an institution, she moved to the town where the institution was and brought him home for dinner every night. And, you know, her friends would think how saintly she was being. And what she told me was that this is just what you do. It's not, you know, you work with your mind and you do what you have to do. And this is what it is, to work with a difficult karma. And I would say that Vedic astrology is very good at pinpointing these things. And in her Vedic chart, her son's birth was the key event in her life. So this is Prarabdha karma. Though it's not so good to get too fascinated with it, these are the situations that provide the template for what we work with in this lifetime. In fact, our Prarabdha karma is really the script of our life. I also think it's very important that the idea of Prarabdha karma not be used as an excuse for people to not do something about social injustice. It also is not always personal, because collective karmas, you know, generational injustices and, you know, sudden events have tremendous influence on the entire community in which they take place. So the whole thing about if bad things are happening to you, it's your fault, is not only not helpful, it's really not true. So because karma is very complicated and very mysterious, as we'll see from a story that I'm about to tell you a little bit later. And there's no question that being able to work with our difficult karmas, which just usually means working with our mind, really makes a big difference. I think it's one of the big things that some of us take on in this life. You know, and very simple actions like giving in charity or kindness will often improve our life in the day-to-day. I know several people whose financial condition improved after they started making regular charitable offerings. Of course, I can't say for sure that it was because of their giving, but they did happen in sequence. And this is actually one of the time-honored ways that the traditions suggest we improve our circumstances. But the most important thing, and the area of growth that is going to impact the way we die, is in our attitude. So I always think of a very good friend of mine who has suffered from radical attacks on his public reputation, engineered quite deliberately by people who held grudges against him. And it's been going on for years, and it has real-world effects, which he has to deal with day by day. But he gets up every morning, offers his day to the goddess, and then works with his mind, sometimes hour by hour and moment by moment, making attitude adjustments and doing his absolute best to offer love and kindness in every situation that he meets. And I have no idea what effect this is having on the external situation, but the growth of his compassion has been incredible. And, you know, this is what is becomes possible when we meet difficulties with the intention to love, to continue loving, to hold blame and resentment in, you know, the container of awareness. But there are always things we can do to mitigate difficult karmic situations. And the stories of spiritual aspirants are filled with just very interesting examples of this. The biggest one, which we're going to work with next week, is forgiveness, asking forgiveness and making amends. Those of you who've been active in the recovery movement know all about making amends. But I want to tell you a story from the Hasidic tradition about transforming destiny. And it also has a kicker that feels fairly appropriate for some of the questions that come up. The story goes that there was a merchant living in a shtetl in Poland who was married to a woman he loved very much, and they'd been trying to have a child for years without success. So finally, a famous wonder-working rabbi came to their town, and the merchant went to see him. He told the rabbi the difficulty, and he asked what he should do. So the rabbi looked inside, looked off into the distance, and then he said, "Were you ever married before?" The merchant said, "No." The rabbi said, "Were you ever engaged?" And the merchant said, "Well, yes, I was engaged to a girl named Rivka when I was 18, but when I met my present wife, I broke off that engagement." So the rabbi said, "Okay, the reason that you can't have a child is because you hurt her and you need to make amends. So what you have to do is go to the town of Łódź and set up your stall in the marketplace. Stay there until she comes. She will eventually come." So he did that, and it was quite a lot of trouble, but he was serious about having a child. And he set up the stall, and he was there for 3 months without ever seeing a sign of Rivka or anyone who looked like her. And then one day, just as he was thinking that maybe this was all a waste of time, there was a big storm, and he'd set up a tarp over his stall and was huddling inside it when the side of the tarp opened and a woman came in covered with her head covered with a shawl, and he moved over to make room for her under the tarp. And then he heard her voice. She said, "You're still moving away from me, aren't you?" And he looked at her and realized it was Rivka. And he greeted her, of course. He began to tell her the story. He apologized for having hurt her. And he said, "I need you to forgive me because I'm suffering the consequences of it, and so is my wife. So tell me what I can do to make amends." She said, "My brother, who's very poor, who lives in a certain village, needs a dowry for his daughter by the time of the wedding, which is in 6 days. Otherwise, the marriage won't take place. So if you'll take the proceeds, what you've earned in the time you've been here, travel to that village, give the money to my brother as a dowry, you'll be forgiven." So the village was 4 days' travel away, and the merchant really had to travel day and night to get there. He finally arrived at the brother's house, knocked on the door. The brother answered, and he said, "I've brought the money for the dowry." And Rivka's brother looked at him in astonishment. He said, "What?" The merchant said, "Look, it's me. It's me. It's Levi. I used to be engaged to your sister. And you know, I met her in Łódź, and she told me to bring the money for the dowry, that if I did, she would forgive me for having hurt her, and I would, you know, we'd be able to move on, both of us." And the brother said, "Oh, my God, you met Rivka?" And the merchant said, yes, I met Rivka." And the brother said, "Rivka died 10 years ago, a few weeks after you broke off your relationship. She died of a broken heart." So there's a very happy ending to this story. The brother took the dowry, and his daughter was able to get married. the merchant was able to have not just one, but several children. And as the story is told, Rivka, through forgiveness and through receiving his offering of amends, was able to move on past the resentment and grief that she might be feeling. So I love this story, partly because it really is about how we can be forgiven by people who aren't even here anymore. And of course, it also shows that even the most difficult situations that are the result of past events are impacted by your present behavior. There's a powerful and important statement in the Yoga Vasishtha that says, destiny and free will are like two elks battling it out, two big horned beasts. The strongest one wins. And then it goes on to say, there is nothing stronger than right action in the present moment. So again, you might want to take a moment now to not to search your mind and heart, but to just notice if there's something in your life that you feel kind of strongly needs to receive forgiveness and amends. Maybe it requires a conversation. Maybe it simply requires a phone call, or maybe there's something you need to do. Just consider. And I'm not suggesting that you start an entire fourth step from AA process, but just that you consider what nags at you right now involving another person. And this is something you might want to make a note about to work with in the coming week or in the future. For me, as I've done this process, which I try to do quite regularly, I'm a great believer in cleaning up my karmas. The thing that really I find, you know, needs work is the feelings of disappointment and resentment, which are part of the regrets that we've been working with, because it's the effort that we make to work with our own mind rather than letting ourselves fall into victim mode or resentment or a feeling of helplessness, especially, you know, for so many of us, it's about our parents. And even if we thought we'd forgiven them, during a course like this, stuff was kind of seems to come roiling up from the unconscious, and not because there's something the matter, but because the energy of the course is kind of showing you that, okay, maybe you need to do a little more with this. It's part of the opportunity. So work with it, practice with it, as we have been doing with regrets, or by using the mantra very, very strongly with a lot of focus. The mantra is a fabulous process for clearing stuff out of your subconscious. Or imagine the situations or held resentment or grief or anger, just gently let it flow out with the breath. Practice with it. Not with aversion, but really with understanding and compassion for yourself. Okay, let's take a breath in and exhale. Inhaling, and with the exhaled breath, let the speculations and thoughts and insights, don't let the insights go, but any swirl that's coming up, let that go. And let the inhalation flow in with Namah, the exhalation flow out with Shivaya. Just for 30 seconds, become aware of your own awareness. just let your attention come to attention itself, to awareness itself, right now. Just touch it for a second. What's aware that you're listening to me? Yes. So we've said that the playground of karma, the place where the experiences that determine our present and future life are on their most powerful display, is our own mind. The yogic traditions make a distinction between what we could call the ordinary mind or the discursive mind and the illuminated mind, which is essentially what we're calling here awareness or pure consciousness. But, you know, in Sanskrit, the word for the ordinary mind is citta, or individual consciousness, while the pure thought-free awareness that's the ground of being is often called cetana. These words for citta and cetana have the same root as the word chit and chitti, which are the masculine and feminine forms that describe the absolute intelligence, the great awareness, the great mind, the source of all. In Sanskrit, a shared root denotes identity, connection. And I love thinking about citta and chit because those two words, the shared root of those two words, reveals the degree to which your personal mind is not only part of the great mind, but also actually possesses creative powers, which, though limited, are not different than the creative powers of the cosmos. And Tantric Buddhism also has the same idea. It makes the same distinction that the ordinary mind in Tibetan is called sem, and the pure awareness is called rigpa. And both of these are aspects of the great mind, which is beginningless and deathless and luminous, and which is often called the Dharmakaya. So obviously everything we do in yoga is about purifying and expanding the citta so that it can begin to reveal itself as part of the great mind of citti, of the cetana, your pure awareness. And it's one of the reasons why, in my experience, it's so important to combine direct purifying practices like mantra and prayer and visualizations with some form of directly turning to awareness, and with devotional practices that allow you to tap into the oceans of grace that are available to us. The citta, which permeates the body, including the chakras and channels in the subtle body, is the fundamental storehouse of all the impressions, all the conscious and unconscious impressions that we carry and that come into play in the way we think and feel. And, you know, this bundle of stored karmas is called the Karmashaya, which is another name for Sanchitta Karma. I like to call it the karmic backpack, where the imprints of our past actions are stored like seeds. Contemporary brain science, of course, has mapped to some extent how these imprints affect our neuronal wiring. And the Eastern traditions, again, this is very famous, and almost all of you know this, consider these impressions to be grooves in consciousness, like scars or wounds in the pure field, which are called in Sanskrit samskaras. You know, in the yogic and Vedantic traditions, these are what get burned by, you know, or smoothed out, let's say, by our practice. I want to tell you a story, another story, which while I was researching this class, I came across a book by Pandit Rajmani Tikkanayat on karma, and it's a hardcore Vedantic story. I believe it's from the Yoga Vashishta, and it's about Sanchitta karma and how it works. So the story goes that there lived a yogi named Jagishavya who undertook a classic, long, uninterrupted practice of deep meditation and attained enlightenment. at least attained a level of enlightenment. And, you know, eventually he found himself in that realm of existence where the ordinary mind doesn't go, and transcended body consciousness and began to see all the relationships between the contents of his mind, his ego, and then he entered the citta, the unconscious mind, where he began to see the dormant karmas related to his millions of past lives. And in this state, he got really, really confused. You know, even though he was in a very profound state of meditation, variety and the intensity of these lifetimes, you know, was utterly confusing. And he realized that he was seeing all his previous lives and that there was no distinction between the past lives and the present. So he continued to expand and to travel deeper into the karmic backpack. And the more he traveled, the more he discovered about himself, and he was overwhelmed by it and also fascinated, which, of course, is what happens when we start looking at our past karmas. He saw that he'd been a king, he'd been an insect, he'd been a demon, he'd been an elephant, he'd been a celestial being, he'd hurt people, other people had hurt him, he'd loved people, he'd hated people, you know, and everything that ever happened to him had created an impression, and they were all stored intact. And the other thing he saw was that even though there was pleasure in it, that there was a ribbon of pain that flowed continuously through all these experiences. And he saw that they would eventually manifest. This is what the Vedantic texts do. I'm interrupting myself here to get us really serious about liberation. But he began to ask himself, so how did this happen? How did I get involved in all this? And realized he didn't have any answers. So he got more and more discouraged despite his samadhi state. And at that moment, a celestial sage, one of the great transcendent masters, whose name was Avatya, sensed his disturbance. And as happens, thank you to all these sages, saw he needed help and so came into his meditation and said, what can I do? How can I help you? The meditator, Jagishavya, said, you know, I just, after all these years, I still have so many karmas, and even after knowing that they're there, I don't know how to get rid of them. So the sage Avatya said, you know, you're actually, by exploring this field of karmas as you're doing, you're actually getting involved in them. And so what you have to do is rise above it and see what lies beyond. So the first thing to do, Avatya said, is to understand why you're attracted to knowing your past. This desire to know the specifics of your past, the things that are hidden, actually comes from the very deep desire that sentient beings have to reclaim it, to revisit it, to replay the story. And, you know, you know that most of your past is painful. You know better than to try to associate it with it. But at some level, you're attached to the fruits of your actions. The sage then said, let me help you. Do you remember how many karmas you have? Do you remember when your karmas began? And Jagishavya said, no, I don't. Avatya said, how do you categorize your dormant karmas? Jagishavya said, well, they're either painful or pleasant. They're hard to deal with or easy to deal with. So which is larger, the painful or the pleasant? For sure, the painful. So Avatya said, understand that when I arrived, you were just revisiting your sanchitta karmas. what you've been doing for all your lives is reinforcing the idea that you are the doer of actions. Your anxiety about the fruits of your actions made you miserable when you performed actions. When the results were bad, they made you feel disappointed and miserable. When they were good, you worried about hanging on to them. And this also made you miserable. So every single action that you've ever taken with the feeling of doership was filled with unhappiness. And then he said, whenever a memory either thrills you or depresses you, it's your attachment giving energy to that related karma. Neutralize it through the power of non-attachment, which, by the way, is actually what we're doing when we do the practice of metabolizing regrets. We're letting our regrets and our karmic situations go. We're allowing them to begin to dissolve. He says attachment is like the nutrients that you give a seed in order to let it grow. So the first step is to really decide not to provide those nutrients as best you can. And at the same time, you're going to begin to recognize some of the teachings of the yoga texts. At the same time, he said, get with your practice. Really get serious about your practice and bring your power of will, your power of desire, so that when you sit for practice, you're very, very serious about it. And in this way, your non-attachment and your practice will very soon free you of these karmic reverberations. So, as I say, this is a hardcore Vedantic story. And obviously, most of us here are not sages. But there is something about contemplating samsara as endless and realizing that our yogic practice, which will allow us to realize more and more the true nature of our souls and therefore burn that karma, it gives us a lot of motivation for working with the mind. So maybe you'd like to stand and stretch for a moment. And we're going to take questions. So you can take a moment to formulate a question if you have one. And as you're doing that, let's just inhale with Nama, exhale with Shivaya. This time, feeling that as the mantra flows in, it's kind of scrubbing the residue of any worries or resistances or fears or whatever that came up in the course of listening to that rather hardcore story. So with the exhalation, you offer that into the great, vast, loving power of Shiva. Namah Shivaya. So you can raise your hand, and you can do that by pressing 2, star 2, I'm sorry, and Deb will call on you. And if you're on the webcast, you can also write your question in that little box on the webcast, and Deb will harvest it, and it also will come into our conversation. So who would like to ask a question?
I had somebody ask a question earlier, so I thought this might be a good time to ask that. Laurel asked, what is the most comforting practice you know? What is the most releasing practice to let go of whatever gets in the way of clear guidance and embodied well-being?
Really good question. There's a few of them. One of them is a very simple practice of really, really getting into the breath and following the breath, letting the belly expand and with the inhalation and move back with the exhalation enough to, you know, kind of open up your lungs in case you're feeling fearful or panicked. And then what I find most comforting, really, is the meditation on the great being at the back of the heart. So imagining the presence of Shiva or the presence of the goddess or the presence of a figure who gives you help and comfort and a sense of safety, imagining that being at your back, feeling the breath flow in through the heart, touch that being at your back, and then feel that with the exhalation, love and blessing and comfort is flowing from that being into your body. And just keep on doing it, even if it's not, if at first it doesn't feel real, until you begin to feel the inevitable presence of those beings who are really ready to reveal and comfort us. And in terms of the most releasing practice, really depends on the moment. Sometimes something works and well, and sometimes it doesn't. I like to release issues with the breath, but I try not to do it with a sense of aversion or desperation or panic, because that kind of increases the baggage. And, you know, the practice that I sometimes teach of imagining a fire and the goddess dancing in the fire, and then feeling yourself remove cloaks from your body, which might be feelings that you're now experiencing or karmic experiences that you may not be aware of at this moment, offering them into the fire, and just keep doing it. Just keep doing it. Just keep doing it until you begin to feel some release. So those are some examples, and thank you for asking. So, Deb, do we have another question from the live call?
It does not appear so.
Okay. Okay, guys. This is your chance.
We just have somebody that raised their hand. So if you just raised your hand and you're in North Carolina, you can speak.
Hi, Sally. It's Gail.
Hi. Hi, Gail.
I have a question. Hey there. I was wondering, like, when we become realized and we're in that expanded state and then we die, what happens then? Because it's always been like, well, this is part of me that still wants to be able to play and to be of service and to continue expanding. And I was just wondering if you've read what the sages say about that.
Well, that's what we're going to start talking about in a few minutes, and we'll talk about more next week. So
okay.
Yeah, that question will hopefully be answered.
Okay. And I had one more about karma. When you were talking about just now, I was trying to kind of absorb it, but you were talking about, it sounded like, not going back and getting attached to old lifetimes.
Yes.
And things like that.
Yes.
But we also want to release karmas from those lifetimes, right?
Well, okay, so this is a very good question, and I'm going to speak to it. So pay close attention. We'll come back to it again and again. Part of the process that we've been doing in working with regrets is releasing karmas, and one of the ways we do it with present life karmas and regrets is we bring the felt sense of it into our attention. We practice either surrounding it with space and letting the feelings melt into the space, or bringing it into the sushumna and letting it melt into the sushumna or into the region above the head. We can do some of the practices that Laurel, that I said, talked about in discussing it with Laurel. But in working with present moment issues, we always want to start by feeling it, because this is what allows the tendrils of it to come up and be released. Now, when it comes to dormant karmas, to old karmas, to impressions that we don't know we have, this is what essentially only our practice can do for us. And I consider mantra repetition one of the most powerful practices there is for reaching into the old dormant karmas. But you need to do it for a while. You need to practice mantra quite assiduously in and out of meditation. You know, when you're working with something that's quite painful or distracting in the moment, you can often clear it out through mantra. But the deeper gift of mantra is the way in which it will both bring up and then release dormant karmas. That's why we do sadhana, is to release dormant karmas. But in terms of what that sage said, which is incredibly important and is not often recognized, is that what we tend to do when we've brought up and released a situation or a painful situation or memory is we start coming back to it. We poke it like a hole in our tooth. You know, there's an old Jewish story, an old Yiddish story, about a man who's traveling on a train, and there's an old man behind him who keeps going, "Oi, am I toasty? Oi, am I toasty? Oi, am I toasty?" And so finally, the other traveler gets up, goes to the drinking fountain, gets a glass of water, brings it to the old man, who thanks him and gulps it down. And then he says, "Boy, was I toasty. Oi, was I toasty. Oi, was I toasty." So that's what we tend to do. You know, we get relief, and then we go back and remember how bad it was or what a good job we did in releasing it. It's incredibly important to remember that once you have released a memory or a karma or a felt sense of pain, not to go back and try to figure out how you did it or what it meant or what it relates to. Other layers of it will come up and you'll work with them too. But what the sage said is very true, that we get kind of addicted to the stories, and it's very important, you know, and of course it's a big practice in yoga, to make the effort to release our attachment to the movie of our life, whether pleasurable or not. It's difficult to do. I completely understand it. But every time you manage to do it, it kind of creates more of an opening in your consciousness. So I hope that answers your question. She's overwhelmed with gratitude. She can't even speak.
I put it on mute so I wasn't going over top of you. But thank you very much. That helps a lot.
So I'm glad you asked that question, Gail, because it's something that we often don't understand. It came as kind of a revelation to me a couple of years ago when I first read this teaching and began to see how, in fact, even though I'd do a lot of clearing, you know, I often get caught up in the story of how I did this clearing and what I cleared. So we can be attentive to letting that go. And, you know, realize that our practice is clearing us. So, and that it's not a spiritual bypass. Wait, I just want to say one more thing. It's not a spiritual bypass to let go of karmas, you know, or situations or difficulties that you have worked to release. It's not part of our duty to, you know, to be present with our own suffering, to hold on to it any more than we can't help doing. So, Deb?
Well, I had somebody else ask a question. Coco asked, so from the perspective of that story, are you supposed to work towards clearing the samskaras but avoid striving to accomplish it because they're actually endless?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Your practice is clearing the samskaras. Your meditation, your mantra repetition, your chanting, your good actions, especially if you do them as offerings rather than, you know, with consciously anyway, the underlying feeling that you're the doer of them. I mean, we're talking here about the big issues of life and karma. And, as the Bhagavad Gita says, which I think is, maybe the last word on this subject, that for people like us, people who aren't going to sit for 20 years in meditation and let the flesh fall off our bodies, you know, we're going to live our lives. What Krishna, if you remember, says over and over and over again is that when you offer your actions, whether you offer them to deity, to guru, to awareness, or offer them asking that the action be of benefit to all beings, it helps release this sense of doership that is the cause of the fundamental cause of our bondage to the results of our actions. So this is the path of life and death. This is the path of life. Finding skillful ways to offer the actions that we're doing now, knowing, by the way, that what you do, especially what you do that's good, is going to give you fruits, whether you attach to them or not. You know, if you're working, you're going to get paid, hopefully. If you're making art or writing a book or raising a child, there's going to be, you know, or growing a garden, what you plant is going to bear fruit. You don't have to think, I did this and I have to make it happen, although we all do. You can do the action, offer the fruits, and you become more and more free in them. So that's a short answer. We are actually going to discuss this at some length because it is kind of the, it's the nitty-gritty of the whole thing. So thank you, Coco. Again, I hope that begins to answer your question. Striving practice, abhyasa, you know, as the Yoga Sutras say, abhyasa meaning effort, practice, is good. You know, it's necessary. We do need to make effort. But what we can learn to do is to make effort without tension as much as possible. You know, we can learn to feel into the tension that gathers around our efforts and release it in the moment with the breath. And it's a very interesting process because you begin to see that how much of your effort is you know, literally permeated with tension. So the effort that you make in this moment to breathe, to take a deep breath and breathe it out before you start to tighten, this is incredibly good work for clearing karmas. So thank you for that. And again, we'll get into it more and more.
You ready for another
question?
One?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is from Marion. She says she's involved with a dispute with a huge bank on behalf of her mother, and she's wondering if there's something for her karmically to process. It has been her impression that this is her mother's karma that she is somehow clearing for her as her duty, as she is now entirely dependent on Marion in her last stages. But Marion is unclear what is hers rightly and what is her mother's. Can you help her tell her how to distinguish, and is there any right way to do this?
Okay, again, really good question. First of all, your mother is part of your soul group, obviously. So you've had relationship with her both ways for a long time, and in a certain sense we could say that's your karma. So I would say you don't have to figure out how much of this is your stuff, because the efforts that you're making to clear up things for your mother, to take care of her, you know, all of this is part of your really, let's call it virtuous, meritorious. It's the thing that we want to be able to do for our parents. It's part of how we, you know, if we have the opportunity to help them when they're old and feeble, it's not only an expression of, you know, it's not only a payback for whatever they've done for us in our childhood. It's also a very, very beautiful way of clearing the sense of obligation and entanglement that you have towards her. So don't try to figure out what the issues are that are your issues. So you can take for granted that because she's your mother, you know, there is entanglement. of course there is, but more focus on the, you know, the help you're giving her, doing it with as much generosity as possible, and also taking care of yourself so it doesn't become such a burden that, you know, that it's painful, even though that does sometimes happen when we're taking care of elderly parents. This is part of your path now, and it's actually a great opportunity to basically do good, you know, to be kind. And also, I just want to say, give yourself a discount, give yourself some, you know, some compassion when it's hard or when it feels like a bother, because that's also natural. And you can offer that and breathe it out and notice the tendencies in your mind that come up when you're under stress or trying to help someone who's helpless. Notice those tendencies, breathe them out, and work to shift your attitude when you feel, you know, uncomfortable or impatient or unkind. It's really, really, really good sadhana, and it's the expression of making positive kriya man karma. So thank you also for that question. And we're going to move on. These are all fabulous questions, which allowed us to talk about some stuff that's very important. So as we move on, let's take a moment to breathe with the mantra. To find that essential channel, so the breath flows in with Nama, flowing down and up with Shivaya. And for those of you who are comfortable with the image of the great being, the deity, the great light over the head, feel that presence, the presence of perhaps Shiva in his yogi form, his beautiful chiseled features, his blazing third eye, the silence and deep, profound love that his form is made of. And if it's another form, imagine that being or feel that being also as embodying spaciousness and compassion. And with the inhalation, feel that you're drawing in grace from that being who may exist as a kind of cloud of presence over your head, drawing it down towards the base of the body with Nama, and then allowing whatever separates you from the presence of grace to flow upward with the exhalation and Shivaya. And if it's more comfortable or powerful for you to imagine this being at your back, embracing you from behind, please feel that presence there at your back, as though that grace-filled presence is holding you. And allow the breath to remain vertical in this practice at this moment, supported, if you're practicing with the being behind you, supported by that loving presence, but allowing Nama to flow in with the inhalation downward, Shivaya to flow upward, up through the crown. So please come back, and if you're in a state of open or closed-eyed meditation. Blessings to that. And I will ask you, I want to ask you to listen to this call again. But right now, I want to start talking about the after-death realms. And I'm going to try not to geek out too much because this topic really does interest me. And we will probably continue it next week. But this is an answer to a couple of questions that have come in, and it's also important for our understanding of the process. First of all traditions, all the ancient traditions, including the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Chinese, I think most of the indigenous traditions as well, certainly many of them that I know of, and for sure the Hindus, the Buddhists, the Christians, the Jews, all the traditions agree that there's a subtle world that we enter after death. There are quite a few things that are shared in the traditions, which I'll talk about later. But one of the things that most mystics and people who contemplate deeply about the subtle realms comes to realize is that they are actually right here. You know, one of the great teachings of the Eastern traditions, which is kind of different from the Western traditions, is the understanding that the subtle world they're not places, they're awareness, you know, they're resonances, they're present all the time, everywhere, right now, which is why we can have an experience of one of these worlds in meditation or dream, and why we feel their emotional resonances from moment to moment. So all the worlds that we're going to talk about are actually absolutely present in your own mind, in your own state, available to you right now. You know, there's a famous Zen story, which I cannot help telling, a story about a samurai who goes to a monk, and he says, "Tell me about heaven and hell." And the monk says, "Why should I tell you? You're obviously stupid. I can tell by looking at your face. You know, I don't even know why you call yourself a samurai. You're probably a fake." So the samurai, of course, is furious. He's been insulted. He draws his sword. The monk holds up his hand and says, "There opens the gate of hell." And the samurai is so struck that he puts the sword back in the sheath, and the monk says, "Ah, there opens the gate of heaven." So that story is pretty much how it is. You know, when you let yourself get really angry and you really feel into how it feels to be angry, even though, you know, anger sometimes feels good and there's, you know, a lot to be said about it, but the experience of being angry, especially if we're resentfully angry, I'm not talking about the fiery assertion that lets us right wrongs or create boundaries. I'm talking about the kind of anger that festers. You can feel that it's hellish. And certainly you can feel that expanded states of joy and freedom, states where our energy is flowing, feel kind of heavenly. So without attaching to them, which just know that we can experience the after-death realms in their essence right here and now, and we do. So when it comes to the realms themselves, one thing that becomes really clear is that our cultural background and our expectations and, of course, our early childhood experience has a lot to do with the way we conceive of the after-death realm and very possibly of how we experience it. I mean, if you read past life regressions, which we'll talk about more next week, you realize that there's some similarity in the way contemporary educated people who are mostly concerned about their relationships with the people they love, etc., the way such folks experience near-death moments is somewhat similar. And whereas people who are very steeped in traditional cultures, especially fundamentalists, and this is true of of people in Eastern cultures as well as Western fundamentalists, they often experience the afterworld according to what they've been taught. So, and I personally, like many contemporary yogis, have a very strong suspicion that we actually create our after-death experience out of the materials dormant in the subconscious, just as we do in dreams. And this doesn't mean that we make it up, and it doesn't mean that they're not genuine realms there. This is part of the paradox of what consciousness can do. We also, as we become more evolved and work with our minds, work with our citta, we do gain some capacity to be the witness of our experience, and even to be creative with it, which we will talk about in future classes. But in any case, this always brings us back to why it's so good to clean the mind through mantra and other practices. So in the realm of how your level of consciousness, your personal evolution as a soul, which in your case is quite high, I mean more than quite high, pretty darn high. You know, you guys are all really very evolved. But and also the remnants of your early childhood experience and your early childhood conditioning, they make a difference in what we believe and see about the afterlife. And of course the obvious example is the belief among Christian and Muslim fundamentalists, and there's similar ones in Eastern fundamentalists, about permanent rewards of reward and permanent realms of reward and punishment, where good souls and bad souls live for eternity. That sitcom The Good Place is kind of a satire on that. But for instance, I recently read a quote from Mel Gibson, the actor, who's a fundamentalist Catholic, who said in this quote that he fully believes that only people in the Catholic Church can be saved. And he says of his wife, she's a much better person than me, but she's an Episcopalian, and the church says she won't go to heaven because she's not a Catholic, and I'm with the church. So he's not alone in these beliefs, though fortunately for most Catholics, more subtle theologians, including, as far as I can tell, Pope Francis, don't see it like that. But I think many of us still carry the remnants of these teachings. And we also carry the remnants of traditional religious beliefs about sin, Satan, punishment, eternal rewards. And, you know, for Eastern influenced people or people who grew up in Eastern cultures, there can be quite fundamentalist ideas about how karma works based on a similar punishment reward situation. So as we talk about this and as we develop, and as we recognize all worlds really are projections within the great mind, we start to realize how much more fluid the after-death worlds are than we think. The subtle realms are very available to people who are dying. If you've been around someone who took a long time to die, you may have heard them actually talking to a friend or family member they haven't seen since childhood. You know, or they'll tell you that they went to a house that they lived in when they were 5. And often what they say in the last days before death just makes no sense to people around them. There's a new book by a woman named Lisa Smart, which is about last words, and she describes her father's last days in which he would seem to be traveling in spaces that had nothing to do with what was happening in the room. He would say things like, I have to get down, or I need to go over there. You know, the veil is often thin between the worlds. And I sometimes feel as though someone who's taking a long time to die, even though it may be uncomfortable or even painful and boring, is in a certain sense practicing. And I believe this is very important in helping us really navigate the transition if we have that opportunity. So what happens as we die is that as the physical body dissolves, the physical senses also dissolve, but our subtle senses, which are independent of the brain and nervous system, at least according to the traditions, remain and come more strongly online than they are in our waking life. I want to say that the most coherent and helpful description of the subtle realms that I know in the Hindu tradition is in Yogananda Paramahamsa's book, Autobiography of a Yogi. And that's the authority that I'm drawing on in these particular descriptions, which we're beginning with today. He describes a long meditation vision in which his guru's guru, whose name was Lahiri Mahasaya, describes in detail the structure of the astral world. And Lahiri Mahasaya talks about how he himself is in a particular world where enlightened beings dwell in light bodies, even though they're also merged with the infinite, in order to help their students and those who are in need of help. So I'm going to begin to describe some of this, both in terms that we read about in the texts and also from some of the gleanings that we discover from contemporary research. So, you know, just begin to recognize the basic premise that the physical universe exists within a larger field that we call spirit or consciousness, which is infinite and infinitely creative. Therefore, pretty much anything is possible in the field of consciousness. And from our point of view as individuals, there are many, many subtle realms which seem to be kind of self-adjusted in order to meet the consciousness expectation, karmic situations of the souls who end up there. So the basic law operative in the subtle universe, and in the physical universe for that matter, is the law of resonance. Resonance, not residence, R-E-S-O-N-A-N-C-E. And I think that's the main point that we want to get across today, because I'm not going to hose you down with details about the subtle realms. We'll touch on some of them specifically, but we'll go into them in much more detail next week. So, you know, we're drawn, just as you're drawn to people with whom you resonate, you know, with whom you feel comfortable, or maybe people whom you aspire to be comfortable with in life. We're drawn after the death of the body to the planes and the places that vibrate or resonate with our own energy at a given moment, with our own consciousness, which, you know, if our consciousness, the body, the subtle body that we travel with in after death, has different aspects to it, one of which is energetic. It's, you know, it's a pranic field. One of it is, you know, one of it is mental. It's a thought field. One of it is what we might call structural. That is, you know, there are subtle senses in it which allow us to experience in the subtle realms. And the flow of our energy, which we very much cultivate through spiritual practice, as well as our mental habits, come into play and help us resonate with, you know, with places where our soul can be happy and joyful. So where we go at death is determined by our resonance. And it's one of the reasons why anything we do in this life to kind of open our energy field is helpful. So it's also true that in the literature on karma, the last thoughts at death have a very strong propulsive force. They are propulsive in the sense that if we are able to be conscious at death with a strong aspiration, it will take us very, very far on our evolutionary journey. The literature that I've examined does not say that a negative thought is going to bring us down. So it's okay if you die saying, oh shit, because your karmas, your practice, and also the beneficial beings, the beneficial energies who will be there to help you, will make sure that your journey is not destroyed by, you know, not having a good thought at the time of death. But if you can manage to have one or a practice, there, it's an incredible opportunity, moment of tremendous opportunity. The texts of Hindu and Buddhist Tantra describe many different subtle planes. They're called lokas in Sanskrit, each one of which has its own vibrational resonance. The closest one to us is called our place, the earth plane, is called Bhuloka or Karmabhumi. The nearest subtle realm is called Bhuvaraloka in Sanskrit, which it, this is the, you know, what we can call the lower and middle astral worlds. And beyond that are a succession of progressively higher subtle realms, starting with Swaloka, which is the vibrational level of the various heaven worlds. And beyond that are even more subtle realms, which are contained in what is called, often called, the causal level of consciousness, or the causal plane of existence, that are called by names like Satyaloka, the realm of pure being, Brahmaloka, the world of the absolute, Siddhaloka, the world of ascended masters, Kailasa, the world of Shiva, Amaravati, the level of the heaven of the Buddha, Amitabha, and there are many, many more. And, you know, the various Christian and Muslim heavens are also here on the spectrum, most of them, I would say, at the level of Swaloka in the upper astral planes. And if you recall the Gayatri Mantra, Om Bhurbhuvah Swaha Tat Savitur Varenyam Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi Diyoyona Prachodayat, what these mantras say is that the light of truth, the light of consciousness, permeates all these worlds, the world of the earth plane, the world of Bhuvara Loka, the astral planes, and Swar, the heavenly planes. In the causal planes, that light of truth is permanent, endless, and, you know, creates our experience. So that one great light of consciousness interpenetrates and holds all these worlds. They're also associated with the chakras. These lokas have different degrees of vibrational density, but they're all here together, kind of like the parallel universes that physicists are so fascinated with these days. They're, you know, it's often said in some of the texts of Vedanta that thousands of worlds are packed into one little square inch of space because, you know, there's no density in consciousness. And again, as we start to examine our own states and our own consciousness, we realize that we do have all these worlds inside, and we visit them, and they're all available to us. So when you're in a state that doesn't feel happy, know that there is a happier state that's there, that's available, and that you can, with practice, learn how to switch into it when you need to. And of course, we do visit these worlds in meditation and dreams. The higher and purer your mental and emotional vibration is at any given moment, the more you're likely to get a sense of these higher worlds. You know, for me, one of the reasons why I love altar practice is because when we create an altar, we're actually cultivating a space in which we can be in the physical world at a much lighter and higher vibration. And this is also true when we do creative work, especially painting and music. Work that has to do with language can sometimes get us involved in thought forms, but the pure expressions, you know, of art and especially music are, you know, very much open us to the subtle realms. So I'm going to leave you with this slight introduction. We'll come back to it next week. But as we close, I'd like to ask you to use your imagination to conceive of a world that to you would be a heaven. And it might be a world of sages, you know, if you're drawn to spending, you know, a few thousand years meditating with the sages, or a place of great light where you might meet deity figures. understand that they're present and that you can use your imagination to kind of bring yourself into a sense of what such a world might feel like. Maybe you've dreamed of it. And in creating such a space for yourself in imagination, you actually seed it into your consciousness and, you know that the imagination that you create today is not the final version. It will undergo many refinements. But if you can imagine that just as you might imagine a future self, you can imagine a place of light, of peace, of joy, of subtle luminosity that you can actually bring into reality in your own mind, in your own energy field, through the power of your imagination. So I'm going to give some thoughts, which you can ignore if they're not resonant. But such a place would have a quality of lightness, perhaps literally. You can imagine its luminosity. It's a place where colors may be brighter, or it may be so subtle that you're not aware of colors, just of the sense of luminosity. The emotional feeling in such a world might be joyous, or it might be very peaceful, but in it there's a sense of relaxation. And whether you are feeling relaxed in your body right now, as you imagine this world, realize that it is a place of relaxation and openness. Just at this moment, ask yourself, who would you like to meet in this world, whether beings or souls you know, or beings or souls that you may not know, but whose presence might feel uplifting to you. This is just a contemplation. Maybe for some of you it'll become very visual. Maybe it's the first time you've ever considered the possibility of imagining a world that you might create in your mind that will become a kind of destination. What might it feel like? What might it look like? Not necessary to be specific, just to get a sense of what you might aspire to, and to realize that you literally deserve the experience of the lightness and freedom and joy of a very beautiful, subtle world now and in the future. And as we take some time, some moments to access or perhaps ask to be introduced to such a world, we're going to play the Devi prayer, the goddess prayer that some of you know, because goddess is, after all, the creative force of consciousness. And we'll just play it. You can contemplate for a while, and then gradually, when it feels right, you can leave the class. So for now, no more talking. Contemplate, and Deb will put on the Devi prayer for us to listen to.
My